Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined, by a couple of good friends. David Soprinus, how are you, sir?
I'm quite well. Yourself?
And I'm good, man. And Jason Wingrove.
Hey, mate. How are you? Hey, Dave.
So everybody's Skyping in today, so that's good for actually, because I can do this from my flame suite, where I'm. It's a little noisy. I apologise, but I have some very large disks burning. I've just wrapped on a project, and I got near the end, and I didn't have enough disk space, so they wheeled in another 600,000 frames for me, which was really quite convenient. But it's a bit noisy.
Well, it's all behind you shortly.
It is actually. We have finished our VFX work, and looking forward to the show going to air in April. Hey,
yeah, I saw the class listing for this semester's FX PhD, and it looks pretty centered around the work you've been doing on Red Dwarf, and it looks pretty like a great offering this term. So,
well, it's interesting.
Congratulations.
Thank you, man. It's an interesting concept because, and I've got to hand it to the production company, Grant Nolan Productions, because they had, you know, like a allocation, if you like, of money for the VFX budget, but they wanted to extend it further, and I've known those guys for many years. And so we came up with this scheme whereby to extend their budget, we basically got FXPhD involved. So we're not actually sort of almost like they're trading the training rights for funding, but obviously it's funding in kind from effects work. So we're managing to do a lot more effects for them than they ever had possible. But it's not like we're stealing work away from some London post house or anything, and that works well because obviously we're a training company, and so we're keen to get members to be able to work on, you know, high quality stuff without and get screen credits and see their work on television. But obviously we're not interested in being a virtual production company and trying to compete with post houses. So it all worked out really, really well.
Sure,
I think
you're
really
sharing
good for
the
students
love.
Too.
Sorry, what was that, Chase?
You're sharing the love.
Well, we are sharing the love. We actually had Finn Design in Sydney who took on a chunk of work, and of the, literally the effects would have had to have been much smaller had PhD not been involved. And of course, it also allowed me to be VFX supervisor on the project, which was great. And then when I got into shooting and principal photography, not on the first day's shoot, which was up at Coronation Street in Manchester, but when we got onto the studio work, they actually made me also second unit director. So I must admit that was a lot of fun being a second unit director.
And I think it's really good for students because I remember quite literally saying that I learned more in my first week of production than I did the entire time I was at school. So nothing quite like the fires of production to really teach you what you have to know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really. And the other thing that's great about it is that, you know, they just phenomenally nice guys. There's quite a lot of green screen work and stuff, so it's all good. But yes, once the show goes to air in Britain, which is April 10, 11 and 12, then we'll be, after that, running basically courses on filmmaking, that some of which heavily use material and experiences from Red Dwarf, which was good for me also because that was a Red shoot shot on multiple Red cameras, as hopefully you and I can discuss on another podcast, Jason.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I hear they're doing a another sci-fi show in Spain called Blue Dwarf, which that will be coming out in 6 to 8 months.
Yes, a very cryptic joke. And I must admit, for those of you that are interested, that yes, I still am thinking that the Red camera is a terrific camera to shoot with, and we did a lot of effects work and a lot of tracking work. And interestingly, before we start on this week's show, which is actually on Battlestar Galactica, I also got a chance to talk to the guys off The Knowing this week for a FX Guide TV. And of course, Knowing was also shot on the Red camera, so we had a great time comparing notes on 3D tracking and stuff. So that was all really good.
Fantastic.
Hey, we are here to talk about Battlestar Galactica and principally about the final episode of Battlestar Galactica. We have actually done shows on Battlestar Galactica before, but I just think that the work that was done by the team, which is now the in-house team of Battlestar Galactica, in Series 1 and to a certain extent Series 2, great work done by Zoic, but they actually set up their own Battlestar Galactica VFX unit, and Series 3 and Series 4 were brought in-house. And I just think that that the work that they did on Battlestar Galactica, both at a story level and at a VFX level, was so tremendously admirable. And the work of Gary Hertz as the visual effects supervisor, I just think that it's worth giving the guys at Battlestar Galactica another episode of our time, because I think this was a monumental achievement in visual effects and, for a certain extent, storytelling, and they deserve another rundown. So we thought we'd do something we don't normally do, which is revisit Battlestar Galactica, and we're going to do that this week with pretty much Battlestar Galactica, the third part of the three-part end series, but I don't think our conversations will be limited to that. But David, do you share my enthusiasm for the show?
Oh, absolutely. I think it... it's very sad to say it was one of the best shows on TV, period, and absolutely one of the best science fiction shows. I know there's a lot of people who get upset when you call science fiction sci-fi. It's like a derogatory thing. But it was incredibly well-written, incredibly well-acted. The production values were through the roof, through and through, and I was a little hesitant when I first got exposed to it. The way I originally got exposed to the show is I got a 4-year consideration DVD set of the original miniseries when that came out, and I hadn't seen the show. I was never a fan of the original, so I was like, meh, okay, I'll put it in, and they had me from like 5 minutes in, and it's truly a remarkable achievement in storytelling and in every aspect of the show. And the effects are so high caliber, period. But for television, they're just through the roof. So well done to everyone on the show.
Yeah, I must admit, I do remember watching the original Battlestar Galactica with the blonde hair. Yeah, you actually saw it at a cinema, didn't you, Jason?
Yeah, I remember seeing it in Sensoround.
Oh, no, I remember the show. I'm just not a fan of the show.
But I think they actually must have... I remember seeing the movie coming out just after Star Wars, and it just obviously felt like such a total ripoff, but it certainly kicked off the interest in the TV series.
Well, I actually went to the Universal ride, and the chariot pulled up, and the Centurions came out in the old days at the Universal theme park ride, and I remember that really distinctly as well. And I must admit, therefore, when I approached Battlestar Galactica the miniseries, I thought this is going to be so bad because I thought the TV show was so cheesy. And the first sign for me that it wasn't going to be bad and wasn't going to be cheesy is that it didn't have a kid and it didn't have a mutt dog.
It didn't have Muffet the Daggett.
Yeah. So that for me was a really good sign.
I kept waiting for it. I thought, oh, come on. No, they didn't have one.
It's kind of curious that they even needed this to be Battlestar Galactica. I mean, obviously they needed the name to get some awareness, but really any relationship between this and, you know, the original is almost coincidental.
Yeah, absolutely. And so and Ron Moore, who's the showrunner and creator of this version of Battlestar Galactica, he has a long history in science fiction writings and for television. You know, he did a long tour on Deep Space Nine. He was going to do actually a TV series based on Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern. A book series that was actually pulled like I think a day or two days before they were going to shoot the pilot. And if you've ever read those books and you take a look at Deep Space Nine, you can see a lot of the themes from those in this in Battlestar Galactica, and I think he has took it to the next level. And it's just amazing. It's an amazing series because the one thing they do that I think is really brave: none of your characters that you love are safe. I don't care who it is. They may die.
Yeah, well, there's so many of them.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that really is interesting because last time we did Battlestar Galactica, we looked at it and an episode and we narrated it as it went through. So what we thought we'd do this week is discuss, as we say, some of the backstory. We're also going to discuss some of the technology behind it and the 64-bit pipeline and that kind of stuff. But you're absolutely right. It's a great place to kick off. Have any of you guys listened to Ronnie Moore's podcast, like where he actually does a narration of the episodes and normally sit drinking scotch and a cigar?
Yeah, it's a commentary available when the show is broadcast. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I found those really interesting, not least of which is because occasionally between various series, they would not put out one about a show. They would actually put out like a taping that went for an hour and a half of the discussion in the writer's room. And there were all sorts of things that I remember, for example, when they first introduced the music, which plays a big role in tonight's episode. And obviously that was a controversial move because the characters that heard this at the end of what must have been, I think, Series 3, that music is modern-day Earth music. And so this was like, you know, hang on a second, how come we're hearing Earth music? But I remember him saying then that they actually had a reason why they chose that, you know, Jimi Hendrix track, and it was going to become clear later. And of course, in this episode, the There Must Be a Way Out of Here became very... very clear. But I loved hearing these kind of setups of character arcs and how they kind of approached problems and what they kind of thought and just how much planning went into this. And I guess one could kind of expect a lot of planning going into it, but also just hearing the layers of referencing. So, for example, on any given problem, when you might have the fighter pilots discussing something in a briefing, they would be referencing the sort of stuff that happened on aircraft carriers, or they, you know, go very deep inside military kind of real life to pull their reference to try and draw on things that would have a resonance. And I think that's one of the things that gave the writing real strength. And of course, that was reflected in the visual effects, because the visual effects was probably first characterized by its use of this more witness cam zoom tracking poorly, trying to find the action kind of approach. Yeah. But that actually, I think, David, we saw that first, didn't we, in Zoic, or at least in, from Zoic in the Firefly, didn't we?
It was used there. It kind of goes back to a lot of actually... That look is came out of some early lightwave artists who would really push the realistic camera physics that they were trying to do. And so I think a lot of Zoic is a lightwave house to a large extent, and I do believe that almost everything in house at Battlestar Galactica is done in lightwave. And lightwave is, and I mean this in a very good way, a very insular community. And it's a very strong community where the people who are lightwave users tend to be, they all know each other through various message boards and email lists and everything like that. And so you get a kind of transference of technique and style that's almost universal among many of the artists working in it. So... I don't think you can really credit Zoic for coming up with that style. I mean, it's a simple emulation of handheld. You know, that it looks like any home video taken at any air show.
Is it really emulated though? I mean, some of it looks pretty real. I mean, I can totally understand why they've gone for it. It totally blends the effects in with the on-set action.
Yeah, it, I mean, it. It what they're emulating
like a, feels like a captured move.
I don't think it's captured necessarily. What they might do is, and this is a trick that I've done in the past, is you go and track a DV camera move. You know, you just throw some points on a wall and yeah. You track the camera move, and you throw that camera on top of your kind of clean CG camera that you wind up getting. But some of the stuff that they're doing, you know, like when you zoom in on a shot, like the reason it feels real is that as you're zooming, you're constantly reframing for your subject matter. So you get your pan and your tilt are organic in conjunction with your zoom. And I don't think they have the technique down, the hardware down for doing a captured camera. That technique is actually being used more and more on certain productions that I'm involved with.
Absolutely.
But
I'm sure okay, they are.
Leaving aside,
so we're saying this is keyframe then essentially, and so all of this handheld through space moves is all pretty much just done with a mouse and tablet.
Well, or they've shot some reference and they've just used the reference to give it kind of a natural feel. Yeah, and you know, I mean, apart from that, you wouldn't get the zoom properties because the you're not focusing at the distances that they're focusing at. To do that kind of stuff, you're not like literally filming fighter pilots. You might have got some air show footage and watched it, but
right. And there's ways you can you can capture without capturing. You know, you can use your mouse as a live input so that you play back your motion and you capture the mouse as you're zooming in on it, and gives it a very nice organic feel. There's certain tricks you can do. But,
one of the things we did on Farscape, Steve Anderson came up with, one of the guys that got nominated with me for the Emmy, was that he got all our 3D department to play a World War One video game fighter pilot thing, and then we actually captured the gaming data as the guys were actually fighting on their consoles, and then applied that to our ships for intergalactic fight sequences on Farscape. And so there are things you can do like that that give it a lot of humanity without actually being sort of a literal capture.
You can't beat that humanity. And to be honest, as I say, I really thought there was some human input there, because all of that battle and all of the sort of camera moves through space, just I was blown away with it. That was probably the most outstanding thing, I think, for me, for the
and
effects.
The least like Trek, if that makes sense. Like, Trek was always about, and I think Dan Curry's work on Star Trek as visual effects supervisor, outstanding, right? I mean, I think Next Generation, you know, we can kind of criticize some of the stuff for Trek as being a bit, these days it seems a bit like it's, I don't know, sugary or a bit cleaner and perfect. But that was the Trek world. The Trek world was one of optimism, and that didn't lend itself to gritty, dirty camera moves and gritty stuff. And when they were doing that with Star Trek Next Generation, that's like at the first days of Harry's and stuff. So this is like really going back a fair way. And it was all motion control because they didn't have the flexibility that the CG models gave. I mean, it'd be really hard to pull off some of these camera moves with CG models, even with modern motion control. I mean, in a sense, Battlestar is building from... I don't like the theory that Battlestar is sort of like better than Trek. I think it's just building on Trek in a new dimension that is valid for this story. And I would assert that, in fact, that's the best thing about Battlestar Galactica. The visual effects tend to work for the story.
Yeah, it does all sort of... Sorry, go, Dave.
Oh, Jason, go ahead.
Well, for me, I guess it was that it all just does blend together and does feel a little bit like, you know, it's like Carrier, the Doco series. It all does definitely have that sort of gritty feel, and it wouldn't match what they've got on set. It has a really sort of, it all does feel like the cameraman's captured it all in one take, and he didn't quite know where everyone was going to go. There's no real blocking. All the actors really feel very unrestrained. They all feel so natural in what they're doing.
Well, in fact, some of the actors go famously off script, right? I think last time we were talking about this, I was talking about the episode where Adama smashed the model boat that he was building for many, many, many shows. And it wasn't until after they'd finished rolling that props came and pointed out that was something that actually hired, and it was actually quite valuable.
Yeah, well, it's I've heard a couple of the directors on Battlestar Galactica speak about this. And it's actually a technique I like to use when I'm directing actors, which is you work with your actors and you make sure they have the scene down, whether that means the lines of the scene or the mood of the scene, and then you just let them go and then you document it. It's not about planning out, okay, now we're going to do our tight close-up. Now we're going to do our coverage over the shoulder. Now we're going to do the insert shot. It's just let it happen and document it, and it feels so much real. And when you take that same attitude and apply it to the visual effects, it just gives thematically, you know, if the show on the inside of the ship looked like it did now, and then you go cut to the outside and it looked, you know, Star Trek-y, where, you know, you have a definite up in the world, you know, in Star Trek, for some reason, all the ships fly at the same angle. You know,
in fact, that was the whole point of the second movie, wasn't it? That that Shatner's character managed to think three-dimensionally and thus beat the baddie, which I always thought was ridiculous that you could even get into space and not think three-dimensionally.
Right.
Wow, breakthrough thinking.
But you know what? I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, as I said, I was doing second unit directing on Dwarf, and I was reminded, I mean, I reminded myself of this. There was tell me if I've told you this story already, but there was way back when I was learning filmmaking, I remember hearing somebody talking about the Pepsi executive with Michael Jackson. Have I said this story?
No.
And so the Pepsi executive is, you know, they did those Michael Jackson ads with Pepsi, a lot of money.
The ones where they set him on fire.
Yes, but before they set him on fire. And so he's dancing, right?
Not enough.
They're in the edit suite. And there's this huge argument going on about whether Michael Jackson should spin three times or four in the cut. And until one point when Michael Jackson apparently left the room to do something, and they grabbed this Pepsi executive And they pulled him aside and somebody said to him, hey, you think you can dance better than Michael Jackson? And this Pepsi guy was like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm standing here arguing with Michael Jackson about whether he should turn or tilt. You know, what the hell do I... And I kind of always take that with me when I'm directing, which is, you know, do I think I know comedy better than the cast of Red Dwarf, right? Well, no. You know, like, do you think you know this character better than the professional actor that's giving that performance? And the answer is, you know, kind of no. And you don't want to be directing, as you said, David, you want to be letting them, you know, have the scene and give the performance because that's what they do. And trying to direct and choreograph at the... I mean, Jason, you must live this, right? I mean, you direct all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it definitely feels like that was my one main sort of takeout, watching these actors and watching the scenes play out. It really feels like a show that's got out of its own way, that they've definitely mastered the idea. They're also very comfortable with each other, obviously. They're all sort of very, very friendly. Very, you know, you can tell that there's a real comradeship and they're so relaxed and the whole sort of what my character is so becomes so subconscious that they can sort of almost definitely immerse themselves in the performance. So I really think that... That for me was one of just as the director hat and not the VFX hat so much. I just some of the scenes, the way it plays out is just ecstatic. I just was it just wonderfully paced.
You know. I think it one of the great things about the level of effects that are on the show and what lends to its quality is. Because the effects artists have proven themselves so versatile and so capable, the writers are free to do whatever they want. Like, I don't think the writers ever were challenged to, you know, put something in a script and go, well, we have to cut that out because there's no way we can do that effect. And I think this is one of the first sci-fi shows where that was really possible. You know, it's and not only was it a sci-fi show where that was possible because there have been others recently, but you know, all the people behind the scenes that aren't creatives on the show, meaning all the one of the amazing things is that all the executives at sci-fi knew they had something special here and let them go and said, here's your check, make us a show and we'll go away.
Yeah,
and they got an amazing show out of it. But the writers, you know, because they weren't getting interfered with, you know, from a network level, and they weren't ever being told, oh, well, can you know, change this plot line or take this story out because there's no way we can do the effects for it. It must have just let them do whatever they wanted to, you know, it let them take the story where the story wanted to go. And that must have been an amazingly powerful tool for the writers.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? The other thing that I'd like to flag, just as a kind of a, I guess it's an obvious observation, but if you're lucky enough to be able to watch this by, say, buying it off iTunes or something where you can step through the frames really well, you know, you just need to step through some of the effect sequences to tell that somebody really loved this stuff. Now, I'm lucky enough to know a couple of the compositors on it, the show and stuff, and they, you know, they're all really seasoned, some of them very seasoned features guys, but what I'm talking about is not so much attention detail in terms of the technical stuff. I'm talking about, like, let's take that shot about 8 minutes in when they've done the jump and it's broken the back of Battlestar Galactica. I mean, there is super fine detail stuff, like, you know, raptors falling out of the hangar bay and stuff, that, you know, somebody just loved that shot, right? And they spent a lot of time just, you know, finessing it and tweaking it and adding little tiny things in that, you know, you could easily have not done. There's like that attention to detail that just, as I say, screams to me, somebody loved this.
I mean, you're talking about a level of shots here that is like Star Wars Episode One, which is only 10 years ago, but now probably back then they probably had to get, you know, probably could get one of those shots out, maybe half a shot out a week or one shot out a week. And these guys are probably churning out one of these shots every day or two a day. I don't know. But, it's absolute testament to the guys to churn out something that was feature film and beyond, cutting edge, not so long ago. And now they're cranking it out, not only matching it, but doing it in a tenth of the time.
Yeah, and it's not only the big glorious exteriors, which there's one aspect of that I want to get back to, but there's an unbelievable amount of green screen and set replacement that goes on in the show. That when Jason and I were talking about the show, when he was first watching it, because watching the finale,
because today is Jason's, the first time I watched it.
Yeah, Jason had never seen the new Battlestar Galactica before today, and he was talking to me and over iChat, and was like, he's like, you know, I haven't seen that many effects, and I was just like, half of what you're seeing is green screen, and it's all set digital set replacement. He was like, oh my god, you know.
Okay, rewinding.
And it's truly stunning, like the quality of work that's going into the show. The only thing that I've actually ever seen in the show that I didn't think was feature film quality were the retro Cylons that were in they were still really really good, but they didn't quite meet the level of everything else.
I actually thought in this episode, the only thing that I didn't... Actually, this episode or one of the other episodes, I think it was in episode one, when they have that shot in the cargo bay and it pans past the fixed museum piece, original Cylon in the display case. And that, I don't know if you picked that up, but there's a shot where the camera just does a track around and it's got, you know, hanging examples of the different types of ships that the fighter pilots would have to identify.
But a lot of that corridor fighting stuff as well. I mean, a lot of the...
The corridor fighting stuff is once they drive...
About Galactica into the other ship, he said expertly. And they start sort of having corridor battles. A lot of the older Cylons that, you know, there's, yeah. Anyway, I wasn't quite convinced with some of that, but it was very, very few things that stood out like that, really, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult when you think about it in terms of, you know, a feature film, that, like, you know, how long would you have to work on something that... These episodes have run about 43 to 50-something minutes, right? Mm. So this is... The three together is a good, you know, sort of feature film. And even if they're shooting digitally, and obviously sometimes, certainly my eye picks up that looks like a digitally captured shot, but... Or a shot that looks digitally captured is what I'm trying to say. But, you know, it's a heck of a lot of material to be generating, even without scanning and stuff. So,
yeah, look, absolutely. You got to sort of forgive them that. I mean, if it's a feature film, particularly if you are dealing with something like episode one, you know, you do it until it's right. And if you're falling behind, we just put more people on and they can all do every shot till it's right. But, yeah, this is a whole different ball game. I have so much respect for people that have to do... series work. It's just absolute, you know, would cremate the average feature film person, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if we just break it down as you would, you know, Michael, like Mike, you'll be the VFX supervisor, and I as a producer come in and go, okay, so we on a television budget want to do, you know, a couple dozen characters, all digitally created, in a hallway. Now, keep in mind, this hallway is dark and light. You know, lots of shadow, pools of shadow,
flashing.
And pools of light. There are
lighting.
Lasers. There are lasers. There's smoke. There's smoke everywhere.
Pyro.
And by the way, everything's made out of chrome.
Oh, did I mention that there are zooming cameras?
Yeah,
handheld camera. Yeah,
all handheld.
No markers.
And, yep, and green screen. And you have 1 week. Good. You just look at that accomplishment. You know, if a producer came to me and said that when I was done crying, I would probably give him a nice big bill. So I don't want to downplay the achievement that's gone into the show by nitpicking, like the one little thing that bothered me. But I wasn't a fan of the original show, but I did notice no capes on the original Cylon. So, saved on the cloth sim there.
They got rid of capes.
Yeah.
Like the Incredibles.
That shot, and, though, that stuff when they're landing on the base ship, you know, when their landing party stuff's coming around, there's some lovely shots there. Just, you know, I mean, the battle sequences have an intensity to them of like a flak over, you know, Dresden or a sort of a World War II kind of thing. But there's some just lovely, they sort of land with their landing party shots and they're just gorgeous shots. But I think you're right. Like, you can nitpick, well, maybe the bit where the, you know, suction cap thing connects up with the ship that doesn't look 100% real or something, but it would be missing the point because the level of complexity and detail in all the stuff, it just has to work overall for the audience and for the story. And it just totally does. Like, you know, if you don't like one little tiny part of it, it's not enough normally to take you out of the show because you...
Yeah, it's brilliant filmmaking on all fronts, really, given all the constraints. You know, that whole, there was this wonderful sequence in third part three, that whole sort of code entering, playing the piano, flashback sequence. Now, obviously, I don't quite know a lot of the pieces of the puzzle that we're flashing back from, but it's still incredibly, obviously, watching this has made me do is make me want to, okay, start from the beginning, you know, go find a box set and, you know, start rebuild, picking up the pieces and start watching it again. Because it's some incredible, you know, that sequence alone really sort of flagged to me that there's a much bigger, very, very big picture.
So let's discuss some of the technical stuff behind the scenes before we get, you know, drift into some other stuff.
But before we get into the technical, there's one bit of artisticness I want to cover, and that's that I think a lot of times people in computer graphics, because of our history, kind of poo-poo flying spaceships and think that they're easy. As someone who has done a lot of flying spaceship stuff back when I was working in Star Wars video games, it is not easy to make it look like people expect it to look. And the actual choreography of the fights, the air battles in the show are unbelievable, and but in a good way. They're completely believable, but they're unbelievable in their complexity and in their construction. And I just want to, you know, the animators who are creating these shots are thinking like the fighter pilots or the Viper pilots would have to think. And the Cylon pilots would have to think in terms of, you know, I can turn around instantly. I can, you know, I can fly to the left instantly. And that kind of stuff is just, it's to be commended that it's not easy to choreograph
physics
to that level. So,
don't you feel sometimes when you look at a frame like that? I feel like that sometimes. You look at a really dense frame like those, as I said, like the flak type shots where you've just got what looks like a whole lot of tracer type fire and just explosions going everywhere. And I almost feel like, you know, they must have more pixels in their HD frame than I have in mine, because that seems to be fitting more information on the screen than I can fit on my screen at that particular instant.
Actually, the first thing I'll say, you know, I usually don't like to. Pull myself out of the storytelling to analyze the effects, but all I can think of is, like, how did they manage to render all those volumetrics so quickly?
Well, let's discuss some of the technical stuff. So we mentioned already this whole relationship to 3D in terms of the path back to Zoic and stuff, which I think is significant because, you know, most people would assume that VFX stuff is pretty much owned by Maya and RenderMan. And so, you know, that isn't the case here. I think that the other big winner from terms of not unusual, but less than obvious compositing packages is the fact that all this stuff is feeding into Fusion. So really this is a bit of an island in terms of sort of general approach. Lightwave and Fusion, both very good packages, but not exactly mainstream, you know, find your freelancers anywhere kind of stuff. And they use Synthize for the tracking. But, I mean, you know, the fact is that it's a 64-bit pipeline, so it's all, you know, able to do HDRs and OpenEXR files and multi-layered stuff that with the best of them. And I think that the fact that they are using HDRI renders from time to time and not faking out the radiosity really makes a big difference. I think this stuff looks good for its quality of light. What do you think, David?
Yeah, I think Lightwave especially has a long, long, very established history in television effects. I'm not a fan of the program myself, but the renderer is undeniably gorgeous, to the level that Digital Domain actually has their own pipeline to go out of Maya and into Lightwave just for rendering. But I think one of the main reasons why it is so popular is that it's very, you know, in computer graphics, we're always battling for that last, you know, 10% of perfection, you know, to get from 0 to 90 is fairly easy.
I'm just going to put it up there. To getting from 50% in Maya's renderer is hard.
Exactly, yes.
Getting above 50% in Maya seems impossible. But yes, sorry, go on.
Yeah, so, but, you know...
just in Maya's renderer, I'm talking about.
Yes, yeah. but in general, you know, that first 90%, you know, you spend your first 10% of your time getting to 90%, and then you spend 90% of your time getting that last 10%. Bit, yeah. And, I've found in my experience dealing with people that who are Lightwave artists is that they seem to be able to get to that 97th, 98th percentile really, really quickly. You know, in like 11% of your time, and it's trying to get that last 3% is like trying to get blood from a stone sometimes, because there's a certain artifacts, and I mean that in the best possible way, but. The Lightwave renderer is an amazing renderer, but it's kind of like Diet Coke, where it tastes really, really, really close to Coke, but it always has that kind of aftertaste that you just can't kind of, you know, get rid of. And that's kind of what I've always felt about the Lightwave renderer, is that it's really, really good, but when you really have to compare it, there's something about it that.
I don't think you could argue reasonably that Lightwave outguns RenderMan. I mean, there's just no way. I don't think I've never heard anyone even begin to argue that. But the question
because it can get to that 97th percentile so easily.
And that's where you need to be for episodic. You need to. I mean, you know, you really
exactly.
You need to.
But you don't worry about the extra 3% then, really.
I mean, most of the time, I think that, you know, really that difference between where Lightwave can get you and where RenderMan can get you, like, I don't think anyone would argue that you could get the same level in RenderMan. But yeah, I think David's right. You can get a long way there and very, very quickly. You know, I mean, the particle stuff in this is pretty good. Like the explosion, Lightwave's particle stuff, as I understand it, they're not using custom fire or fume or anything else plugged in. It is the particle stuff out of, do you know that, David, if that's out of Lightwave?
Yeah, I believe that everything that they're doing is stock, off the shelf, you know, no custom code in terms of rendering or plugins or anything like that. It's just really talented people using it. The plugin market for Lightwave is kind of dried up a little bit compared to where it was years ago. You know, most people have moved their resources over to creating plugins for 3D Studio Max or other packages, but I think also a lot of those plugins, you know, 3D Studio Max has this amazing volumetric plugin called Fume Effects that
Fume is very good.
Fume is unbelievably gorgeous. So is Krakatoa, but they're also unbelievably slow for, you know, the level of work you need to do for HD resolution. You know, if you were to build a fully volumetric nebula in Fume or in Krakatoa that you had to render it at full HD resolution, you might be able to get one frame done in the time that the Lightwave guys had finished all their shots, you know, doing their hypervoxel renders. So it does what it needs to do. I think if you were to take every single shot in Battlestar Galactica and put it in a feature film, and I don't, most feature films they'd be more than good enough to be in a feature film. You know, if you're talking about your triple A summer tentpole movie that has a effects budget equal to the gross national product of you know, any
reasonable any country size in country, the world. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
You know, I think every single shot would be labeled as a CBB. You know, it could be better, but good. You know, it's like, okay, this is good enough. But you know, if at the end of the movie we have more money and more time, we'll revisit it. And you know,
I mean, I think that's a really valid point, though. Like that you just don't get points in television for taking a long time doing something. I mean, you have to let go of a shot. You know, when you maybe don't even want to, like, it's just not an option to spend 3 weeks on a shot if you've only got 2 weeks. You know, I mean, like Heroes or something, right? Has like literally like a 2 week period on any show when they're you know, out of editorial and before they have to go to air. And you just, you know, it doesn't matter how good you'd make it in 3 weeks. If you've got 2 weeks, you've got 2 weeks. And like, I'm sorry, guys, thanks for playing. And you can't even criticize someone for that because that is the game, right? Like, that is what you have to do.
Yeah, the very first shot I ever animated in a feature film, and this is years ago when budgets were a little bit more generous and bids were a little bit more generous than they are these days, but it was a 23-frame shot. 23 frames, one character. And I was given 9 days to animate it. So it's, you know, it's not unreasonable to expect it in a series television. You know, I worked in serious television for a very short period of time, and I was expected to do 4 to 5 minutes of animation, finished shots, including animating, lighting, rendering, any compositing they had to go in, per week, all by my lonesome. So, you know, we always have that classic pyramid of production. You know, you can have it good, you can have it fast, or you can have it cheap. And I know for a fact the show, you know, is done on a pretty reasonable budget for television. The effects are quite good and they're also being done quite fast. So,
yeah, you know, this is not like it's NBC's number one lead show on major primetime. I mean,
no, but
Sci-Fi Channel.
It was the Sci-Fi Channel's number one show.
Oh yeah.
So, and it was, you know, they managed to find that perfect balance of the triangle of it's good enough, it's fast enough, and it's cheap enough. And they kept it in perfect balance. And that's something to be commended on the production side. You don't often see that.
Yeah, it's a rounded triangle.
A rounded triangle. Actually, it's a triangle with the corners cut off.
Yeah. Cut corners.
That's very inside baseball.
So let's keep going with the tech stuff because we're on a roll here. So do you guys know much about how the footage is captured? Have you do you have any insight into the pipeline in terms of its? Because we discussed the 64-bit pipeline in terms of the VFX, especially the CG shots. But obviously, there's a lot of live action integrated in. Does anyone know what camera they're shooting on?
I believe it's F900, F950. Yeah, as far as I know. So Sony CineAlta. 2/3 inch chip.
Yeah. And, I mean, that is pickable for me. Like I don't know what you guys think, but I mean, there are shots in the corridor sequences where I get the 950-ness of it.
Well, that's more, not so much the 950, I'd say. I mean, because a lot of the other stuff where they probably had a little bit more light, it looks like they've broken the sort of 180 degree kind of shutter rule when we got into the, pretty much all in that corridor stuff. It almost seemed to be like they started to get a lot of motion blur coming in there, like they had a greater than a slower than 50th of a second shutter.
And it felt a little tapey.
Got quite smeary and quite blurry. It almost, a lot of that stuff in the hangar sort of corridor battle at the end there almost looked like there was a lot more noise. Almost looked like they swapped to a different camera. Some of it almost could have been like HVX 200. So, yeah, not quite sure there. It definitely did have a sort of another look coming in there in that, those sort of scenes. But, yeah, look, for the rest of it, it all looked pretty good. But, yeah, definitely... did look a bit sort of tapey at times.
Well, this is, of course, the team that won the Emmy. They won back-to-back Emmys, didn't they, for Battlestar Galactica in terms of the VFX work. And I think that the area that it is probably most impressive in is that integration of live action and CG, because while we discussed the CG a lot, it is absolutely the case that when you're stacking it up with those set extensions and even digital characters in the scene, your eye goes to it. If it's a digital character or you're unaware of it on the extensions. And I think that the matching that they've managed to pull off is really
definitely
good.
Definitely. All the hangar stuff. There's a lot of crane moves where you zoom in on like a few people in the cockpit of a Raptor, and you can see behind it is like a set extension. What you can't see is a set extension because, as we've said, I watched nearly a whole episode before I realised that that's what they were doing. That, you know, clearly they extend the set back and there's a whole lot more other Raptors all with their canopies closing, or there's interactivity in the background as well. And, I never once saw a shift in perspective it all seemed incredibly well integrated. There's no dodgy matte lines because there's so many other things going on. There are reflections of glass and canopies of the Raptors, and
the guys are using Synthize, and you got to give a shout out to Synthize, because that is a pretty awesome piece of software for 3D tracking.
Yes.
Have you used it much, David?
I personally have not. I've actually gotten quite a few Twitter questions over like what I use to track, and my answer is always I use a tracking person to track, which I've always found the easiest way of doing something.
Excellent piece of equipment.
Yannick, yes, who was head of our tracking, was basically using Synthize and PF Track, and we had occasions where Synthize was really kicking it. So I know that Battlestar Galactica used it, and it's not that expensive. And personally, I think actually 3D tracking is a great way for someone to get into compositing, because if you understand 3D tracking and you understand 3D enough to do all that, then you're in a really good position to move into a modern pipeline. I think it's like a great place to kind of cut your teeth if you're wanting to get into the game.
But as you said, it wasn't just the tracking. It's also, you know, the light matched, the shadows were the same. You know, it was just really
different.
That's the hardest thing when you've got, essentially, there was a couple of shots towards the end where Adama's walking through the launch bays, I guess, and you've got this sort of, essentially, the set of the launch bay, you know, almost for another sort of 100 feet, and they had a reasonably wobbly kind of a bit of movement in it, camera move, craning through the launch bay, and it was really quite impressive that you didn't sort of suddenly go, aha, I can see that stanchion there is where they put the mat line, and from behind there, everything from that way on, you know, has got completely different blacks or completely different, the color temp's completely off. It all really sort of sat well. So as you say, not just the tracking, but the elements were all graded and had all the right look as well.
To answer the previous query, the only back when I was in a place where I had to be tracking, Buju was like the big new toy that everyone was using for tracking, and that's my only tracking experiences in Buju.
I've kind of gone off Buju a bit. I mean, I was into Buju a year or two ago, but yeah, and not that I have anything against City 3. I think it's great. It's just that for some reason I started liking the breaking up the tracks in PF Track, so you can do multiple different segments, linking them together, and then Synthize seems to be so cost effective you can afford to have more seats. So
I'm very interested in, I've heard, but I haven't investigated personally, that now PF Track is has some pretty cool tools in terms of stereoscopic for, you know, comparing the left eye and the right eye, and enhancing your track that way, by having a knowledge of 3D space, which is pretty darn cool.
Yeah, that it is really good, the stereo stuff. Actually, we were over at Animal talking to the Knowing guys, and on the really, really hard shots, they use 3D Equalizer, because as you guys know, 3D Equalizer is the kind of big mama. It's the hard to learn, but if you keep plugging away at it, it will get better and better and better until it's acceptable, kind of, and so to a certain extent, I think of 3D Equalizer as the kind of the hardcore, it's the man's version of it's not the plug and play, but it's if you have to get a shot for Lord of the Rings and you've got, you know, nowhere to go, 3D equalizer's kind of the, and I know that certainly that plane crash in Knowing with the you know, that 3 minute shot, that's what they were using on that.
The interesting thing about tracking as a whole is, you know, when you're trying to track something for integration into a scene, you know, you may be tracking it for a full 3D set extension or for a matte painting or simply for something like wire removal or what have you. It's a tool that we kind of take for granted now, like to track, to, you know, you can almost, you know, if you have really clean markers on your green screen, that are completely visible, like you always have 5 markers that are visible, you know, you just kind of have to, yeah, you know, you scrub through your shot, you know, say, you know, here's this marker, here's that marker, here's that marker, here's that marker, and go, you know, and it's like, okay, 20 minutes later, you have a perfectly tracked shot. You know, that's for your like dream shot. But, you know, it's back in the day, you had a frame by frame by frame, you know, you'd have your little grid, and you'd have your proxy geometry and you'd have to line
yeah, I remember
it up
for the thing about Twister when ILM did Twister was just the precision of the hand tracking was unbelievable.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think this is one of those, you know, this show, I'm reminded, you know, Battlestar Galactica has a lot in common in its aura, if that makes any sense, to Babylon 5. Because, you know, Babylon 5 had a kind of similar history where originally the visual effects were done via a vendor, and then they were brought in-house to, like, a visual effects group that was set up just, you know, by the production in order to do the visual effects on it. But one of the things I thought was done wrong about Babylon 5 that was done so right on Battlestar Galactica, you know, in Babylon 5, they would show you this, you know, beautiful vista of, you know, an alien planet with all these little details going on of, like, a reflecting pool and ships flying by and all this kind of stuff. And then they cut to a set where it was two people in really bad makeup, yeah, you know, looking out at, you know, around this cardboard pillar at a, you know, either like a glowing translite or a really bad, you know, it would be a blue screen and it would not be really well comped or tracked, but, you know, the CG reality was so perfect and so detailed and had everything going on that it had outdone the production design of the live action, and it made the live action look extra cheesy because I'm talking the later seasons of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, no, that's exactly.
Or later seasons of Babylon 5, rather.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that the CG guys in Battlestar Galactica always kind of were grounded in the world they created. They never went above and beyond doing stuff that was overly cool just because they could. It was like it was all there to just blend in and be perfect. And it's just
It between internal and external. It moved much more seamlessly between non-effect shots and effect shots. Battlestar has that down in that they don't, you know, because pre-tracking, of course, we used to have that whole thing where the action would suddenly stop and we'd go to a locked-off camera and then we'd have our effect shot and then we'd start moving the camera again. And it metaphorically felt like that in Babylon 5, and it doesn't feel like that in Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, you'd always have your actors pointing right at the camera going, oh my god, look at that. And then it would cut to, like, you know, a plate shot of, like, a CG alien, energy ball, and it would cut back to your actors running away screaming.
Hey, I gotta swing the conversation before we run out of time to, and, you know, if we're not in spoiler alert mode, then we definitely are now. I just need your opinion on the ending, because the ending is perhaps unexpected 150,000 years later. David, you're immersed in the culture that is Battlestar Galactica. What do you think of that that ending?
Well, to be honest, I saw the ending coming.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I had kind of figured out... let me backtrack a little bit. I was really into Battlestar Galactica, and I'd watched it all the way up through season 2.5. And then other aspects of my life kind of took over my life. And so I had not gotten around to seeing season 3 or 4. And recently, as people who follow me on Twitter know, I got a dog, a little puppy. And one of the things about a puppy is you kind of have to watch it all the time. And you don't necessarily have to watch it, but you have to be there even when he's asleep or whatever, because you never know when he's going to get up and go to the bathroom on your floor or gnaw on something that may electrocute him.
I'm sorry, this is tangentially, yes?
But... yes. So what I did is...
Stick with it, Mike. Stick with it.
Why I'm sitting there with my puppy, I watched season 3 and season 4 of Battlestar Galactica pretty much back-to-back.
Ah, okay.
Episode after episode since January of this year. So I was watching 3 to 4 episodes a day, when we were getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to take care of the puppy. I'd watch 3 or 4 episodes before going off to work. And when you watch the episodes, it was like season 3 was on, and then season 4 was on like a year and a half later, and then the second half of season 4 was on a year and a half after that. I think people kind of didn't see the complete through line of some of the plot lines they're setting up. But when I watched it one after another, after another, after another, I could feel where they were headed with it. And I was completely satisfied by the ending, and I was not angry or anything like that. I loved all the little touches that they did with it, in terms of like sending the guy named Galen off to a small island in the north, that kind of stuff that, it's just set up, oh, he's going to be an Irish god and all this kind of stuff. So
send the accents where they would have gone.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was nice. But but the 150,000 years later robotics on the monitor stuff?
Oh, you mean the whole showing the we're about to screw ourselves by inventing Cylons?
Yeah. That's great. I kind of liked it.
You know what? All I'll say is if somebody builds me a robotic version of Six, they can completely wipe out the humanoid race as long as I get a Caprica Six.
By the way, I can just say Six is really tall. I stood near her at the Emmys, and she's really, really, really tall, that woman.
She's I did notice how tall. Short the guy that was walking with her all the time.
He's normal. That she is just like my wife was like, my God, that woman's tall. It's like, yes, darling, and she's quite famous too. But yes, but would you think that? I mean, any comment? No, David, on this the ending? No, you just thought it was.
Well, I was still kind of geeking out over Ron Moore's little cameo he did at the end. But I had no problems. If the Cylons are coming, they're coming.
and he's reading the National Geographic, right?
Yeah, he's at the newsstand. Yes. Yeah. But I mean, I had no little like I could it was possibly a little heavy-handed. But I didn't see it as being anti-technology or whatever. But the robots are coming.
I like she has her hands on him. Do you notice that? Like she actually has her hands on his shoulders when he's reading the National Geographic.
No, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I guess check it out. Hmm. Which, is a very significant plot point if you're reading the boards. But anyway. Okay, so Jace, did you like the ending?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's kind of how it
should
have
ended.
You don't
have a puppy story, do you? I don't think we have time.
Okay, go ahead. Hey, don't make fun of my puppy.
No, I'll keep it brief.
I love dogs. Okay, yep, go on.
Anyway, so, I mean... I mean, I guess that's how it really should have wrapped up, really. I mean, obviously, again, I'm not blessed with the whole backstory thing, but obviously part of the whole continuing thing, and even in the old series, the whole setup, they had the massive voiceover about the ragtag fleet heading to, you know, try and find a new world. So, you know, it was kind of, obviously, that's where they should have ended up, come back to Earth. I quite liked the whole 150,000 years later thing. That was really kind of clever. I thought it was quite cool, to be honest. As I say, watching these last three episodes has made me want to do is to go back and, albeit the ending is spoilt for me, but I do definitely want to go back to episode one and start finding out what I missed, because I've been just listening to Twitter for, you know, almost a year now, banging on about BSG, wondering, what the heck is BSG? What is that?
It's funny, you know, sometimes you can't get into a show because people tell you great things about it, and the more they tell you that you would love it, the more that you think, you hear that, you go, yeah, I'm not into it, I'm not going to get into it.
Yeah, and I've got some really good un-geeky, un-sort of sci-fi kind of, the most un-sci-fi people that I know, you know, saying, oh, you got to watch this show, and I'm just sort of really surprised that, you know, they can get into it. Now, having seen it, you know, with a lot of what I've appreciated and what I've taken away from it probably is some fantastic, apart from the fact that, you know, it's obviously it's a fantastic package, but, you know, some brilliant performances, a great storyline, great characters, you know, such brilliant execution. It's no wonder that it does have such a wide-ranging, you know, appeal. You don't have to be a,
look, and I'll,
you know,
also
a
say
sci-fi
that
person
in the earlier
to,
episodes,
to love it.
It had very heavy political resonance for the war in Iraq and stuff. There was just such a, that's diminished at the end here because it's really not what it's about, but there were some really, really significant pieces of what you'd almost call political commentary that were going on.
Well, that's what science fiction is for.
I mean, it gets a bit gaudy for me at the end, but, you know, it's always been like that, the whole Adama sort of thing.
He doesn't
been,
like to be
been.
Called that. we have to wrap it up. I want to thank you guys for joining us. I actually really enjoyed this week's discussion, a bit more substance to talk about, and just complete respect to the guys at the Battlestar Galactica crew. Shout out to Shannon, my friend there. And but look, guys, yeah, really great, great, great work. I think we're universal in it, our admiration for the work, and, you know, I'm sure it'll go on to live as an example of a turning point in episodic sci-fi, and I'm sure its influence will resonate for many, many shows to come.
But that's it. It's done. It's finished. It's over.
It's
yeah,
a wrap.
But now they're doing a spin-off, and they're doing a miniseries later this year.
But still, I think that'll be seen as being a really significant point in television.
Absolutely.
Hey, where can people find you, Jace?
Probably best thing, Twitter. Quite
on the
often.
Twitters?
Quite often. Sadly, I've been twittering a bit too much this week between projects, as we shall we say. Wingrove on Twitter, and or jasonwingrove.com for my website.
And David,
you can of course find me on Twitter as David Strapenis, all one word. I have not been twittering too much the past couple of weeks. I'm coming to the end of my current project.
But soon
project
to be between projects, yes.
Soon to be between projects, so
I could barely breathe in the last week of my project. I want to thank KM, our producer, and Laurie Anthop for her great dossier on Battlestar and great research and help. This has been a combined production of FX Guide and Pixel Corp. We appreciate your time. If you want to check us out, go to www.vfxshow.com. Until next time, thank you so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. And thank you guys for being a part of the show.